Good. So what we'll do now is we won't read through the passage first because it's a long passage. And what we'll do to make best use of the time is I'll read it as I go through it. So I hope this isn't too dense. Thank you for praying, Perks. Let's get right into it. I've called it Two Patterns of Leadership. This is a heavy topic. We're talking about abusive leadership and good leadership here. There's a lot of reasons why we might want to talk about abusive leadership at the moment, aren't there? But I think the best reason is that we're going through the Bible and we find that God talks about abusive leadership. Now, you know, obviously we've got to be careful we aren't reading into the Bible our contemporary concerns. We've got to be careful we're not skewing things by what we just happen to be especially sensitive to at the moment. But I've just been thinking, what if God could be sensitizing us to stuff that is actually there in the Bible that maybe I haven't seen so clearly before? And the more I've looked at this passage, been going through 2 Corinthians, the more I'm seeing that God is very concerned about our patterns of ministry, our patterns of leadership. And that's what these couple of chapters are all about. It's really what the whole letter of 2 Corinthians is all about. And it's a big concern in the Old and New Testament. But particularly in 2 Corinthians, it's all been building up to this climax of the argument. So chapter 11, verse 1. I hope you'll put up with me in a little foolishness, says Paul. Yes, please put up with me. He's going to be a fool for them. And so the whole letter of 2 Corinthians has been full of emotion, hasn't it? He's been opening his heart again and again. But here he says, I'm going to go into overdrive. He's saying, I'm taking off the safety catch. I'm taking off all the restrictors. I'm going to give you everything I've got. Irony, sarcasm, extreme language, drama. I'm going to play the fool because this is really serious. Foolishness is the theme through this section. You can see that from a glance at the outline on the handout. It's foolishness, particularly in the sense of him talking about himself. He doesn't want to do that. He said before in chapter 4 that he wants to preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord. But now he's got to talk about himself. And the first thing he tells them about himself is his great fear. This is the first point, his great fear. So verse 2, I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Such important verses. Christ is the husband here, isn't he? The bridegroom to whom the church is betrothed. Such an important category, Jesus as the bridegroom. That's why he took flesh, that he could be our husband. This is why he died. He died to win us, to pay a dowry, to buy us for himself. And he's in heaven now, longing for his church, desiring the day of the wedding banquet. So Christ is the bridegroom. The church is the bride, promised to Christ. The whole point of creation is that there would be a bride for the Son who would glory in the Son, would enjoy and love the Son by having this sincere and pure devotion. And Paul, what's Paul? He's the friend of the bridegroom. He's like John the Baptist. He's the best man. And his task is to bring people to Christ, to betroth them to Christ. That's what all his ministry, all his labour is directed towards, seeing their love for Christ kindled and inflamed and increased. That's what he's jealous for with his great intensity. And so his great fear is verse 8, that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray, literally seduced, from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. So a few questions for us straight away. Is that how we see gospel ministry? Christ the husband, the church the bride, and our job, as Richard Sibbs put it, to woo for Christ, to preach in a way that paints the loveliness of Christ, that inflames people's love for Christ. Is that the center of our ministry? Clearly, it won't be all that we're doing, because like, if you're the best man at a wedding, you've got to organise the ushers, you've got to check the flowers and the drinks. But is the heart of your ministry bigging up the bridegroom, getting the church to focus on him? You know, another question is related to that. Is the goal that we're striving for this sincere and pure devotion to Christ? Not just that the church can understand the Bible, not just that the church can teach the Bible to others, but that the church would be devoted to Christ. You know, understanding the Bible, hugely important. Teaching it, you know, equipping people to teach it to others, hugely important. But it's love for Christ that's the active ingredient. That's what changes people, and that's what glorifies Christ, that the people love him. Is that our goal? And perhaps a test for that, what is your greatest fear for your church? You know, if you imagine the kind of the pastoral dashboard, what makes the red light flash on that dashboard? You know, what makes the alarms go off? What makes you think we really need to address this urgently? I mean, I guess there's a number of things, aren't there? You know, that would be pastoral crises, impending divorce, sudden job loss or bereavement or a serious accident, you know, a safeguarding issue, drug abuse, non-attendance by what was a core family. You know, fine, those you know, serious issues, you're going to send in the pastoral troops there. But what about if there are families in the church who are attending regularly and they're doing well financially, physically, marriage-wise, but they're being seduced from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ? For Paul, that gets all the red lights going. That gets the buzzers going off. That is his greatest fear. But how exactly are they being led astray? Well, he flags it up in verse 4. This is a deadly serious gospel issue. But we'll come back to that in a bit, to verse 4. The next point is he explains his pattern of ministry that the Corinthians were despising. This is the second point. Verse 5. I do not think that I am in the least inferior to those super apostles. So he's setting up a really clear contrast now between himself and those who he says are clearly super apostles. You know, these guys are on a higher plane. They are the supersonic men of God. These are the field marshals on the Lord's battlefield. Verse 6, I may indeed be untrained as a speaker, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. So the first way he's unlike the super apostles is in his teaching. They were all style, but no substance. Paul is about substance and straightforwardness. And the second way he's unlike the super apostles is in his funding model. And this seems to be a, you know, a really big thing for Paul, because he mentions it repeatedly. Verse 7, was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I've kept myself from being a burden to you in any way and will continue to do so. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Achaia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. So the Corinthians had this model where you get what you pay for. You get what you pay for. If someone's good, we pay them. If it's free, it's probably rubbish. But Paul uses the most dramatic language he can reach for to say, yeah, was that a sin? Do you think I don't love you? It's because I love you. I stole from other churches for you. You know, that's a very dramatic way of talking about support raising, isn't it? I stole from other churches for you. But the thing I really want us to see is verse 7. So the middle of that verse is Paul's philosophy of ministry. He says, was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? Lower myself to elevate you. Which sounds a lot like Jesus, doesn't it? Though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that through his poverty you might become rich. That is servant leadership. Verse 8, I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. It was sacrificial service. There was sacrifice on the part of the Macedonians, and there was sacrifice on Paul's part, because it's hard raising support for gospel ministry. It's humbling to raise support for gospel ministry. And that was in addition to his tent making that he was doing. That was also hard work. But he knew that in this particular evangelistic context, where people, he didn't want people to think that they had to pay for the gospel. And in this particular cultural context, where there were paid orators and there's this worship of power and money and wisdom, he needed to demonstrate a completely different way. And the point for us here, I think, is it's not the precise funding model, it's the ministry philosophy. Loving, so serving, lowering yourself to lift others up. That is the Christ-like pattern, and it provides a stark contrast to the false apostles. So verse 12, and I will keep on doing what I'm doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. For such people are false apostles, deceitful workers, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then if his servants also masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. So notice again, there's a parallel again between the activity of Satan and the activity of the false apostles. Eve was seduced by the serpent from a sincere devotion to Christ, and the false apostles, like the serpent, they pretend to be on your side. They masquerade. They don't look like Darth Vader, these guys coming along. They look like good church leaders. They have the appearance of godliness, but it's a masquerade. They're actually leading the church away from Christ. But the question is, how exactly are they doing that? Well, we've already got a clue that from this section that they're probably not teaching like Paul, and they're probably not doing their funding like Paul. But the next section gets into what exactly is their pattern of leadership. This is a third point. Verse 16, I repeat, let no one take me for a fool. But if you do, then tolerate me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting. In this self-confident boasting, I'm not talking as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, I too will boast. You gladly put up with fools, since you are so wise. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you or puts on airs or slaps you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. That is abusive leadership, isn't it? Verse 20, enslaves, exploits, takes advantage, puts on airs. That's literally, it says, lifts themselves up. So whereas Paul lowers himself to exalt them, these people lower people to exalt themselves, and they even slap you in the face. I remember a few years ago, I was watching a video clip that someone sent me of a Benny Hinn mass meeting where he got people up on the stage and he was literally slapping them and they were falling over. And it made me so angry. You know, partly they were falling over because of the push, and partly through this emotional manipulation. But, you know, I hesitate to mention that example because the danger with those sort of extreme examples is that they have that sort of danger of playing us all on side, because I think I'm not that guy. You know, I'm not Benny Hinn. But the dangerous thing here is that this is a lot wider than the Benny Hinns or the names that we know who've fallen in the last couple of years, for a number of reasons. One is, you know, this is just the normal default setting of the flesh. This is how we all naturally operate outside the Garden of Eden, isn't it? Exploiting, taking advantage, manipulating, lifting ourselves up at other people's expense. All leadership is naturally going to tend towards that mode in differing degrees, but this is in a sense the flesh's default setting. Another thing is that this is often disguised. So abusive leadership is often not obvious. Remember, you know, these guys are masquerading as apostles of Christ. So it's unlikely to be obvious. It's often going to be behind closed doors or the exploitation will be done in such a way that even those witnessing it won't be completely sure what's going on. Also, this is wider because it's accepted, and that's the real shock here, it's actually accepted. So verse 20, you even put up with anyone. So Paul is not, he's not blaming victims here. The point is that there's a whole church culture which is complicit with patterns of abusive leadership. It's accepted. You get it in the Old Testament as well. So in Jeremiah 5, it says the priests rule by their own authority and my people love it this way. So this is about a church which is actually happy to turn a blind eye to the pride and pushiness and self-promotion of its leaders, because they're brilliant preachers and they're successful in turning around a church from a decline to growth. Because this church, the Corinthians, they have an idolatry of wisdom and power. And the irony is that when you worship those things, you end up submitting to these wise, powerful people and you become foolish and disempowered. And the thing that really gets me here is that these leaders were almost certainly orthodox. So all the commentators agree on this. There's hardly anything in the letters to the Corinthians to suggest that these super apostles were heretics in the doctrinal sense. So they were almost certainly orthodox on the humanity and deity of Christ. They're almost certainly orthodox on the nature of the atonement. And that's one of the things that makes them so hard to spot as false apostles, because they preach apostolic doctrine. So the issue is not doctrine, it's ministry philosophy. It's leadership patterns. That is the issue. But the ministry philosophy becomes a functional heresy. So if you go back to verse 4 of this chapter, verse 4, for if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the spirit you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. You notice the put up with there in verse 4 is the same word as in verse 19 and verse 20, put up with. So the way I think we're supposed to understand this is that the other Jesus, the different spirit, the different gospel are being communicated by their pattern of leadership. So Gary Miller says it's their arrogant rejection of the way of the cross that is theologically poisoning the church. I find that very striking. You can be an orthodox preacher, but a functional heretic in your pattern of leadership, because it doesn't picture the gospel. It's not lowering to lift up. It's lowering people to lift up yourself. So Paul says, to my shame, verse 21, to my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. And there's obvious massive irony there, and it's teeing up the next section, which is all about boasting in weakness. So this is on to the fourth point. Whatever anyone else dares to boast about, I'm speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast about. So this is Paul finally getting into his actual boasting. He's given us a big build up. Now he's going to go into full on fool mode, into boasting mode. And this is the most sustained, powerful rhetoric of the whole letter. You can see that, try to put it there on the outline on the handout. There's loads of form to this. There's a kind of poetry to it, which just ratchets up the emotional level again and again. So he starts with four ways in which he's a match for the super apostles. Are they this? So am I. So am I. So am I. I am more. And then that last, I am more, becomes a drop-down menu to four ways he is more than them. And that's where it starts to turn in an unexpected direction, because he doesn't then list how he's preached at more conferences, written more books, and planted more churches. He speaks of labors more abundant, prisons more abundant, floggings excessively, deaths many times. And then he does a drop down from deaths many times to unpack that. What does he mean by deaths many times? To unpack that in terms of six afflictions. And most of them are with numbers. So 5 lashes, 3 rods, 1 stoning, 3 shipwrecks, 24 hours in the sea, travels many times. literally. So see, he's got this repeated many times. There's a poetry, there's a rhythm to this. And then we drop down to unpack his travels many times. Why were those travels so hard, Paul? Well, he gives us eight dangers he met on those travels. And most of them are in pairs. So dangers of rivers and bandits. So that's natural dangers and human dangers, COVID and crime. Then fellow Jews and Gentiles, city and country. Sea, that's the obvious danger. False believers, a hidden danger. And then the poetry continues. In labor and toil, in sleeplessness many times, in hunger and thirst, in foodlessness many times, in cold and nakedness. And then verse 28, besides everything else, so besides these mainly external things, there's an internal pressure. I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. And then two questions that unpack the experience of that daily concern. Verse 29, who is weak and I do not feel weak? Or that literally it should be, who is weak and I am not weak? Not just that he feels weak, he is weak. He shares their weakness. That's really important. And then the next question, who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? So Paul is jealous for them as the friend of the bridegroom. And so Paul sums up what he's doing, what he's been doing. Verse 30, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness, which is, that is an amazing sentence. We can get over familiar with that because we've heard it before, but that would make no sense to the person, people first reading that. How can you boast in weakness? That is an oxymoron. You clearly don't boast in weakness. You boast in stuff, your strength, proud of. So Paul he's subverting the whole idea of boasting. He's turning upside down their whole value system, which prized power and success and comfort and glory, just like ours does. And he's going to unpack that further. But I just wanted to pause at this point and just clarify what is this weakness that he's been boasting in through verses 23 to 29. I think it's really helpful to clarify. It's hard work. Labor, toil. So you get that in verse 23 at the beginning of the section and verse 27 near the end. And all the way through, there's just loads of activity and he's constantly on the move. So it's just important for us to notice it's not, when he says weakness, it's not a passive, inactive sort of weakness. It's weakness in sweat and exhaustion, labor. Also, it's persecution. That comes out really strongly, doesn't it? Prison, floggings, rods, stoning. Opposition. It's also about danger. It's really striking to me. The longest list in that kind of section is the dangers, the risks, eight of them. Not necessarily that he was actually afflicted by each of them at every time, but he was vulnerable to them. He was risking natural and human dangers. And then there's the deprivation and humiliation. So particularly as it concludes, verse 27, sleepless, hungry, thirsty, cold, and naked, like Christ on the cross, stripped, naked. There's that sense of sacrifice and of shame. So it's a humiliating thing to be stripped and naked. And then just how he finishes it, the pressure of love. So verse 28 and 29, he's tied to the churches in such a way that he shares their weakness and their waywardness hurts him. That's the sort of weakness Paul is talking about. And then he gives the witness of God and the witness of a concrete example. So verse 31, the God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I'm not lying. Let me give you an example. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me, but I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through his hands. So there you've got an example, persecution, danger, humiliation. This is an unsuccessful mission trip with an undignified, uncomfortable, unsafe exit. Then go on to chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 1. I must go on boasting. Although there's nothing to be gained, I'll go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. And now Paul tells us what he could boast in, but refrains from boasting in. Verse 2. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, but God knows, was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible things, things that no one is permitted to tell. I will boast about a man like that, but I will not boast about myself, except about my weaknesses. Even if I should choose to boast, I would not be a fool, because I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain, so no one will think more of me than is warranted, by what I do or say, or because of these surpassingly great revelations. I think in J.C. Ryle's Christian Leaders, it talks about one of the 18th century leaders, that they were never concerned if people thought too low of them, but they were mortified if people thought too highly of them. And that's Paul here. He could boast about visions and revelations. He's been to the third heaven, done that, but he hasn't got the t-shirt, and he goes out of his way to talk about it in this strange kind of oblique way, because he doesn't want to boast in that. He doesn't want to boast in anything except his weaknesses. Therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. So when Paul was talking about his third heaven trip, he used the third person, and he wasn't permitted to tell what God said. But when he starts talking about his weaknesses, he's very happy to go into first person and to say what God said. So verse 8, three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. That is the central thesis of the whole letter. This is the secret of Paul's ministry, ministry out of weakness, so that the power of Christ is at work. You know, we had that in chapter 1, where Paul wanted us to know about his afflictions. We've got it in chapter 4 with the jars of clay stuff. But here it's even clearer. We've got the Lord God himself saying, my power is made perfect in weakness. And then finally, there's this appeal. And this is the final point briefly. Verse 11, I've made a fool of myself, but you drove me to it. I ought to have been commended by you, for I'm not in the least inferior to the super apostles, even though I am nothing. I persevered in demonstrating among you the marks of a true apostle, including signs, wonders, and miracles. How were you inferior to the other churches, except that I was never a burden to you? Forgive me this wrong. So Paul is drawing together his argument from this section, and he's driving it home with an ironic, you know, sarcastic, really. Forgive me. You know, I've obviously committed a terrible sin against you in serving you for free. I've obviously done a great wrong by not abusing you. I think he's using this really extreme sarcasm because he wants to shock them into seeing how messed up their value system is, to see how messed up it is that they could prefer a pattern of self-exalting, self-promoting leadership rather than a pattern of Christ-like servant leadership. And there's the same challenge for us. You know, have we really got our heads around this paradoxical truth that God's power is made perfect in weakness? Or are our hearts being seduced, at least in part, by the gods of success and safety? You know, when you look at a leader who's athletic and dynamic and impressive, and then you look at a leader who's preaching from a wheelchair, Who do you think is going to be more powerfully used by God? Now, I might say I believe this verse 9. I mean, for a long time, this has been one of my favorite verses. I might even preach it. But do I really delight in weaknesses? Do I embrace them? Do I see hard work and opposition and danger and pain and pressure as opportunities for Christ to become greater in people's eyes and for me to become less in people's eyes? That's the end. Over to you.